I'm going, I think for the record, as well as it's my present duty to formally introduce Pat Rogers, and so I'm going to do that anyway, even though you all know it. Because I think we are being recorded as well. It is indeed a pleasure to welcome Pat Rogers, who is the school's visiting professorial fellow this year. It's a double pleasure for me, having had a recent joint lecture with Lynn Sinclair in English, and now to host another English event. Pat Rogers is the Department of English at the University of South Florida, Tampa. He's a distinguished university professor, and that's a distinguished with a capital D, both I think in its title and clearly in his background as well. Holder of the DiBartolo Chair in Liberal Arts. He's taught all over England and Wales before going out to the States. He's been a fellow in Cambridge, a visiting fellow in Oxford and in Otago. He's a fellow of the Royal Historical Society, a corresponding fellow of the English Association, and a corresponding fellow of the British Academy. His teaching covers just about everything from the 17th to the 20th centuries. Concentrating on his research more, which focuses on the long 18th century, all aspects of that, from literature and politics to medicine, science and more, where he's of course particularly welcome in the Institute of English Studies is his interest in the history of the book, descriptive bibliography. He's recently been working on the rogue publisher Edmund Curl, which is what he's going to talk about today. But he's written 11, or edited, written and edited 11 books on Pope, numerous books on Johnson and Defoe, Jane Austen, and so on and so forth. So we really are, I remember being on the committee that made this appointment, of course, and we're absolutely delighted to award Pat Rogers this school visiting professorial fellowship. And over to him.
Thank you very much. This is my last chance, so I'd just like to thank you as former dean to convey to the present dean and to all the people in the school and in the institute my gratitude for allowing me the great honour and great pleasure to come here. Okay, I'm going to spend about 10 or 15 minutes just saying a little bit about Curl's fortunes and particularly the surprising rise in his reputation in recent years. And then the rest of the time, about 20, 25 minutes, just taking you through the catalogue which Bob Burns and I have tried to compile of his publications. But before that, well, you know who Curl is.
No.
In fact, well, some of you probably know almost as much about his life as Paul and I do. Paul, by the way, is now, being a British academic, on the point of becoming head of school and has been deputy head, and so the last two or three years I've had to come and do it alone, but he's, our interest goes back intensively on the catalogue for a decade. In Paul's case, probably longer than that. In my case, BCE, really, forever. Curl, we think now, was born in 1683, though nearly all the reference books still say 1675, which was amongst the best guess, but no longer. But we don't know where he was born, despite digging around in record offices for decades. We don't know who his father was or mother. It says his father was a tradesman. We found his two marriages, but we don't know much about the brides, and we don't know when the first wife died. We know that his son Henry, who was to succeed in business and worked with him, died before Curl made his final will and gave a little doggerel account of his life and his fortunes. So the biographic record outside the book history record is pretty thin. We don't have any of his accounts. There aren't too many 18th century publishers, but we do have good business records. One or two printers like one in Bury, not too many booksellers. So we have to really put the story together from his external evidence, from his publications and so on, and his dealings. A few of his trade sales survive, but not very many of those. Not many entries in the stationer's register because he was not a member of the company. He was, in fact, a cordwainer. The three ways you probably know he could become a member of the livery, either by patrimony, his father we don't think belonged to any company, by apprenticeship, which he did not do, at least as a bookseller, or by payment, and he qualified by payment. And that is one of the things that makes him a little bit of an outsider of his career, as he's not a member of the main trade organisation. Okay, now turn to his reputation. You will know that the publishing industry in general, its reputation soared in recent years, owing a great deal to the creation of the discipline we started reading, history of the book, founded by Roger Chatier, Daniel Bosch, Robert Downton, and others. An academic respectability once achieved seems to ensure that the object of study acquires a good name of its own. And today, this esteem covers, cloaks the most begrudged colporteur of soft pornography, dodging the authorities in Neuchâtel or Whitefriars, as well as the great publishing dynasties who set up shop in the Boulevard Saint-Germain or Pall Mall. Small private presses have attracted their devoted bibliographers, and in an era when the big bad wolf of multinational conglomerates threatened to take over the industry, who could be afraid of the Hogarth Press? Journals specialising in history publishing began to spring up, and with the rise of electronic aids, a growing number of trade archives became accessibility online. But respectability has its limits, surely. Could anything rescue the most slippery customer of all? It was good to discover the anonymous toddlers in pre-revolutionary France sneaking out their libel and cunning scandalous as part of a grand project collectively to throw down the old regime. But this line of defence would do nothing to raise the stature of the rascally bookseller Edwin Curl, who more than anyone else dragged his profession into disrepute. In 1927, the author of a losing biography, Ralph Strauss, chose an apt-looking title, The Unspeakable Curl. Nobody then considered this a misnomer. After all, this year marked the bicentenary of a trial in the King's Bench, which dispatched Curl to the pillory. Not, by the way, for obscene libel, as often stated, but for a political offence. By general agreement, no better than a wild boy, he deserved all he got for the harsh way he treated his stable of starving writers. In the old Cambridge History of English Literature, he represented, quote, the nadir of the profession. Yet even Curl has begun to prosper mightily. 8 years on, we dare to speak his name with approval. Articles and websites now trumpet his virtues. The debate whether it should be placed on the heroes or villains of Grub Street. The worst of publishers has become, in some quarters, a standard bearer of the freedom of the press. Couldn't be a likelessly beneficiary of this new history book. Of course, his reputation has encountered warmer breezes because of global changes in the climate of historiography. As Keith Thomas has written, quote, every aspect of human experience now has its historians. From childhood to old age, from dress to table manners and smells to laughter, from sports to shopping, from barbed wire to masturbation. This represents good news for the publisher of Onanism Display. It's possible to suggest specific reasons why Kerr might have gained from a programme chiefly bent on rescuing worthy members of the trade, such as Thomas Cadell or George Smith. Most of the recuperative moves that have lifted him out of his former dignity have depended, in fact, on half-truth, illusion, fable, outright error. In the first place, the tendency has grown up to regard Kerr as a rebel. Qu'est-ce que c'est qu'un homme brevetté, asked Camus, and he naturally didn't say an answer. The term meant, he declared, un homme qui dit non, given the possibility to go among her resistors. True, Kerr often found himself cast as a naysayer in an opposition stance, but generally because he'd failed in his efforts to win the support of powerful interest groups. More than once, the authorities turned the heat on him, and Kerr promptly shocked his colleagues, even informing against so inoffensive figure in the trade as Samuel Richardson, in his capacity as printer on Augustine's. Once carted off to jail, Kerr's first instinct was to drop as many printers and booksellers as he could into trouble, with the aim of negotiating his own release. Thus, in 1724, he told Prime Minister Walpole that De La Riviere Manley had a new installment ready of her notorious bestseller, The New Atlantis. Spike may have entered his motives for impugning what he called a libel, as he'd never managed to get a share in his lucrative work, though he did pass off a number of books completely unrelated to the original, with titles such as The Northern Atlantis or The German Atlantis. When Manley died later that year, Kerr promptly got out an edition of her semi-autobiographical Adventures of Rivella, misleadingly titled Mrs. Manley's History of Her Own Life and Times. So keen did the bookseller become a machinery informant, he actually proposed to Walpole some form of reward for himself. He'd been told that he might, quote, depend on having some provision made for him in return for his unwearied diligence to serve the government, and that he would expect to be given something in the post office. The Secretary of State, Townsend, had assured him he would recommend me to your honour for some provision in the civil list. In the stamp office, I can serviceable. Kerr did not have in mind a job as a counter clerk. It meant that he would manage the oversight of the press and winnow out seditious publications. When forced into a tight corner, he proclaimed his affection for government and denied knowledge of suspect material. Neither was there one copy seen or sold in my shop, he used unconvincingly to assert when the authorities got on top. But all this while, it now turns out, he was voting against ministerial candidates in the City of London elections, which is how he was called. A decade later, he tried again and sent the Treasury, still headed by Walpole, a proposal to appoint an inspector to look after the stamp duty and bring the government an additional £10,000 a year that was currently evaded by those who were producing ballads and pictures and music. Hardly the record of a man who died in the last ditch for freedom of speech were the words of Harry Potter. The Sign of the Times, what I'm talking about, comes with a paper by Janine Barchas, presented in 2006 at the Sharp Conference. This is the one which sets up for debate, quote, Heroes and Villains of Grub Street, Edmund Kerr and Samuel Richardson's Shared Business Practices, and suggests that the 18th century book trade was in fact far less polarized in practice than conventional accounts suggest. All well and good, provided we remember a few things. Richardson did not obfuscate the publishing history of his books by altering titles or dates, or issuing spurious editions of a work simply by inserting a cancelled title page, as Kerr did on literally scores and scores and scores of hundreds of times. Unlike Kerr, he did not invent bogus authors with names resembling the great Joseph Gay, one of his favourite authors, or rig publicity to suggest that Addison was responsible for the book. When only a brief paragraph by the preface comes in the master. He did not engage in a variety of duplicitous practices by which Kerr conceded his involvement or misrepresented the circumstances under which your work was issued. He did not advertise old books with a pretense of originality. It took a Kerr to do these things and to exploit many similar devices year in and year out. We'll see some of them. So they were both booksellers, but they were both booksellers in the sense that Cecilia Bartoli and Amy. in white, I suppose, singers. A second reason for this surge in popularity lies in the famous Cromwell Pope. On a variety of grounds, some understandable, Pope has long excited hostile reactions, and today he's often portrayed as a traitor to the literary brotherhood who fouled his own nest by savaging writers and publishers in the Danzig and elsewhere. For some modern commentators, they've discovered that he himself, Pope, operated close to Grub Street. One writer says, Pope himself was not above using deception, trickery and chemistry to get the better of Curl. It's easy for us to see that Curl was acting large authority, he quotes, by printing poems, letters and other material he now paid for no received payment permission for. But as Curl himself asked Pope, who gives you the authority of punishing me? End quote. This writer, John O'Brien, got his students, graduate students in America, to take part in a mock trial, setting poet against jury, against bookseller before a student jury. The jury returned what he thought was, quote, a splendid and appropriate verdict, finding both men culpable of wrongdoing and sentencing them to be placed in the stocks in spitting distance of each other. The students, he says, were able to articulate the issues in great detail and complexity, and when the opportunity came, cross-examined each other shrewdly. It does not appear that the issues under review extended, for instance, to the degree of literary merit. And then another teacher, Bradley K. Much, enlisted graduate students in a class on research methods to assist in a project involving 18th century liberty in literature. He reports that members of the class, quote, eagerly transcribed Venus in the Cloister, of the nun in her smock, as a way to sharpen their knowledge of textual criticism. Perhaps the first time such a motive has led anyone to peruse this infantile piece of pornography. After this, the students, enthusiastic about justifying the ways of Edmund Curl to man, planned an edition that would appeal to the modern reader. Curl would surely approve this scheme since he craved respectability and success. This points to a third factor which has abetted the publisher's rehab program. Curl's heavy involvement in soft pornography has become a positive asset, and his willingness to take on authorities is now seen as another blow for freedom of press. Some might think it a pity he did not challenge the limits of law with something more substantial than Venus, by his tracts on impotence, flagellation and sodomy, mostly inferior translations of flimsy items written in decades earlier and not very exciting to read. But at least he took on a minor establishment and drew out a full retinue of the government's legal officers. It was really a political book, though, which embarrassed Walpole's ministry, which earned him his time on the Rostrum, Charing Cross, etc. In any case, now that both the erotic texts and popular culture have come to seem more worthy of study in many quarters of the distinguished literature, Curl's stock could hardly fail to move backwards. A few of his smutty books have been reprinted with full scholarly and veritas in the Pickering Chatter's edition of 18th century British erotica, 2002, suggesting he may be in line any day for posthumous pardon from the Royal Society of Literature. Readers could excuse for thinking that Curl played the part of a noisy Jehodiac in punk pushing back the boundaries of artistic expression. Sadly, he produced nothing comparable to Virginia Man, The Naked Lunch, or The Leader. Instead, his legacy was to make the world free for Roger Fuqua's new description of Maryland and a tract called De Secretis Liber, text equally bereft of literary merit and medical value. But, in any case, we did not have to wait until the 21st century to recognise that Curl and Pope were locked in a symbiotic dance. The bookseller himself liked to point out that there is a pickle need. He often inserted little vaunting rhymes into his editions of the poem. Quote, a fitter couple sure were never hatched, some married are, but we are matched. In the same way, a colleague in the trade, named Thomas Paine, who often shared an imprint, brought out a Paris epistle to Burlington in the end of 1731, and he too bedecked his newspaper ad with a state caption. It is impossible the air should part, Pope has the public ear and Curl on their heart. Most likely Curl wrote these lines. Modern commentators who declare the two antagonists were as bad as one another have an ancient precedent. to claim that he was back in to kill himself. Finally, it happens that the books had a different comedy, and much of his career played out itself first as pathos and then as farce. Strauss's biography confirmed this impression of a genial master of ceremonies, cooking and snooker sandwiches of a rigid age. In fact, many of Curl's letters to the authorities when he found himself in trouble veer between a vein of Pecksniffian smugness and a deep vein of self-pity. Nor did the hacks he employed for always finding funny when he doled out 4 or 5 guineas for the labour. That was the way which Robert Sambo worked for translating marketable items such as Unicus and Display in the Praise of Drunkenness. Okay, just to end this a little bit. Nearly 50 years ago, frankly, Ian Watt wrote an essay, Publishers and Sinners, The Augustan View. This remains, I think, in some ways the most perceptive analysis of the topic today. In it, Watt explored aspects of the new marketplace in books and the frequently hostile response of writers to the practice of developing trade. His conclusion was that Pope and other alarmists were in the sense right. Something like Sainte-Beuve's Littérature Industrielle, in 1839, was coming into being. He actually referred to Pope's own gallant stance in the face of this, a phrase rendered almost unimaginable today by the imperial growth of book history and the tendency to justify the works of even sleazy commercial operators. It has become an act of temerity to point out that Curl didn't really make any significant contributions to the publishing literature, if we exclude instant cut-and-paste biographies and jumbled centos made of Provenzo sheets derived from last season's tickets. Some paradoxical phrases can deliquesce into routine and meaningless couplets. Thus, lovable rogue, which is applied to Ronald Biggs and people like that, has lost almost all force of oxymoron, because the first word undermines the second. To speak of Edmund Curl in this way is to upsize some accidental features of his career and blot out the rest. It does no service to history publishing to confer a spurious legitimacy on one of the least scrupulous practitioners. Okay, now a great change of gear, a disjuncture, because despite all I said, and partly of course, from a lot of provocation and constraints, he clearly was a very prominent and salient person of his time who had important dealings with Britain and the writers, and also reprinted a lot of important literary and historiographic and antiquarian books from previous centuries. So, despite all I said, I think he's worthy of study. The main problem has been, though, that it's such a bibliographic mess. I know Strauss did a surprisingly good job in 1927. A lot more remains to do. Is that largely relatable? I'll just summarise some of the points I'm going to put. Paul and I have tried to scan surviving copies from all over the world. Strauss doesn't seem to have gone beyond the British Museum Library that then was. He didn't even go to find his way to Oxford. Let alone to the repositories elsewhere in Britain, copyright libraries, and of course he never went to America. And that's understandable in his time. We have found that there's a unique copy in the University of Otago, a thing of this kind. So that's one way we're trying to, I'm not making a few vaunting claims, but we're trying to do something more. It gives a much fuller description, Strauss just lists titles, including basic physical features, collation and so on. It gives a full transcript of the title, price. Then it tries to discriminate between rural editions and many fictitious ones, eliminating numerous ghosts that appear in Strauss's list. We think that probably 100 to 150 of the items that Strauss noted in advertisements were simply inventions. A few possible, but many of them just, if you got a book that hadn't sold well enough last week, you simply announced their second edition. No second edition has ever been found anywhere in these cases. And I think in many cases they are certainly ghosts. Its entries, some of these I'll go through into more detail in a moment. The entries explore many co-publication arrangements, so a significant amount of cooperation colleagues. Newspaper advertisements and magazine lists, we'll come to these again, have been more systematically scanned. Again, Strauss only had the British Library, British Museum Library, holdings to go on in. Then it supplies a serial number for each item, chronologically year by year, so there is a single precise reference, whereas Strauss is only in this sort of booksellers, antiquarian booksellers, collectors, and librarians have always done this in Strauss 276, but that might have 20 books on it, page number. So we're trying to provide a unique number, which is of course a big change in the way that now. Then cross references to the main bibliographical sources such as Foxen and the SGC. Tries to establish a normal, and the most important thing is supply a full publishing history, because it's constantly moving items from one volume to another. That's one of the problems. And then it says here, I think it contains 14 indexes, it's now 16. We're coming to these now. And these is the current context. The asterisk are simply those who, well, and it's me doing this, done. So there's the main catalogue, Dubia, which we probably won't include all Strauss's ghosts because there are just too many, many things which we think about ghosts happening as that in the past. Then these various indexes. The authors, editors and translators, I put less than 500. That is an overestimate because I've done the first third and arrived at a total and multiplied by three, and foolish, a very foolish step, because I realised the remaining two-thirds of the remaining report when you listed. That was a very elementary error in haste. Probably more like 350 to 400 authors. Bibliographical listings, I may have got that. That's in things like the Gentleman's Magazine and things like Cairns, Monthly Review, Monthly Catalogue. Then some of the others, I'll show you brief excerpts of the entries, so we needn't go through them all. I think this is vital for it, and this is one of the reasons, by the way, something you might want to talk about when I finish, why we think it's better probably as a print edition than as a, online. The arguments both ways, and if we could get it published either way, we would take it to the online publisher. There'd be a tremendous amount of scrolling back and forward if you had it online. With good printed indexes, we think you can do, as it were, two fingers. You don't need to be thinking through a tremendous amount of things at once. And then you see the various other categories, such as I've added the index of wills, because that wasn't always big man was publishing the wills of the recent deceased. Okay, I won't stop longer on that.
Can I just ask? Yeah. 20 publishing addresses?
Yeah.
That's within London?
Yes.
And how many of them were real? I mean,
all of those, I think.
So was he shifting?
I'm actually going to show you.
Was he shifting? Okay. Was he shifting his press around all the time?
He really wasn't a printer. He didn't have a press.
Thank you.
He was never a printer.
Okay.
It's his retail. It's basically a retail bookseller. So he moves shop.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll give you some examples.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Sorry. This is his yearly output, and if you read it, sorry, it should read 1706. It's got squeezed out on the left hand side when it started. And I won't linger on this too. You notice there's a big curve. Rachmaninoff have said that a climax should come three quarters away through a career, well, through a piece. And his climax comes a quarter of the way through, around 1714-15. There's a very simple reason. These, I think it would be agreed by people studying the subject. Around the time of the Hanoverian accession and the first Jacobite rebellion, was a big spike in output, over 1,000 separate publications, possibly for the first time, a total which I think was not reached again until the 1760s. So it was globally a big spike in publication.
In titles? In titles, not necessarily output.
Sorry, all right, in
you're using but the title.
It works.
Yeah, work.
Correct. It goes down 1720 South Sea Valley. It didn't do much on the bubble, but you might expect that. It goes down, I think, partly for reasons of his being in prison quite a lot in the mid-1720s. Why so low in 1730, I have no idea, after a big push with the Nuncio in 1728. And then mostly it's a decline story. 1740-41 go up because he found a bunch of fuckwells in Maryland. Treating the female bodies as an atlas, as a map. In 1745, he was publishing several editions of a Hanoverian mock prophecy. The Captain Western. He dies out. There's one publication in the year he died, December 1747. We think he was blind, probably totally blind again. Okay, this is the form of entries at the moment in rough form. They're in draft, and I think they're mostly fairly obvious things. We do not go into very heavy duty bibliography in the sense of press figures, catchwords, running heads. It's a fairly stripped down description, just enough to give. And this is often very, very hard to assemble. Often no two copies are alike, as bad as the first folio. He binds things in completely random order, even when they were apparently sold as bound rather than stitched. They come in any order, shifts things around. Second editions also vary the order for no obvious reason. Contents will come at the start of the introduction at the end of the book or the end of the introduction. In one case, at least, in the middle of the book. That just some shambles in the dedication in the middle. So there are... Okay, I get on.
So now putting in format, you know, or are they all on paper?
No, no, we do a good format, it's not a state of the
art. So don't say anything in this?
Sorry, true. Very common is Octavian Falls.
Yeah.
That is one of them. Not usually for long books, but for his stock pamphlets.
Yeah.
That's the most common form of that. Sorry, that's an omission. As I said, this was in the draft. And there's a very simple case. That's a duodecimo. Some are much longer, much more complicated. But it's a complete title page. Certain abbreviations always used, such as PF for parenthesis. EC is used throughout to mean E dot curl. Capital E dot capital C curl with two L's. If there's any other spelling or variant, it is given. But if that is the form, it is used in C. And this is a cross reference to where it had come from in 1715.
Who is H.C. to be published next week?
Oh, sorry, that's Henry Curley's son.
Okay, thanks.
That's the only other person who has it, if it's a new one, person's abbreviation. And this is another relatively simple one. Again, the most important thing is probably to relate it to cross-reference to the other places that appear in the house. And follow these kind of wandering through from one thing, Pope's poem, The Worms, which is, I think, the poem that's most frequently reprinted in Pope's lifetime. Kirk reprints in about 12 different places. Sometimes in the same setting, sometimes not. Okay, there will be probably editions of some of these. Oh, it's a complete edition. That's a thing called, that's one of the very tight ones. Oh, here's the first page of the imprint one, which goes on for another page or two. This is chronological. He starts out in the Strand, goes back to Fleet Street. Oh, he had actually worked for a man, wasn't apprenticed for Michael Smith in Paternoster Row. So, in a way, he's Then he goes to just stand in the street, has a shot in town, he's retired, ends up in Strand, and then we haven't had this, but in fact, he then moved to the Bow Street, Covent Garden, Russell Street area. And this is, in a way, the trend that I think the trend was going is good, moving from the historic centre in the Paul's Churchyard, in Ulster Road, moving down to the city in the Strand, and then collecting around Covent Garden in the theatrical area, in the kind of Red Line Place area, of course, in the Law Students area, and that was the trajectory. For a long time, he was quite near King's College, or St. Mary's Strand, just to the west of where Kingsway, all which comes out of the Strand. There's a street called Catherine Street, which goes up towards the Roger Brewer then, that way.
Yeah.
He was on the Strand on the south side, right opposite there. Mm-hmm.
But most of those addresses, apart from the last one, are outside the city of London. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
So, but he is able to operate within the city of London, and therefore come under the Jew. And Paternoster didn't
go. Well, he was dodging that. It's only for a very short time he goes to Paternoster.
So he is outside the jurisdiction of the Lord Mayor of London.
Yeah. But he wasn't, that may have been his intention, but as you know, he wasn't alone in there. Mm-hmm. His shop in Fleet Street is very near Bernie Lintox.
Who was a reputable puppet?
Yes, not the very highest, but typically one. And his shop further along, when he was a bit further along in the Strand, was very near Jacob Thompson's. Mm-hmm. But it's a good point to make, in fact, he kept outside the jurisdiction of the city. This is, of course, an out of parish. Right. St. Dunstan's. So it's out ward, it's Farringdon ward without. That's probably too small to read. It doesn't matter, the details don't matter. These are some of the publishers and printers with whom he worked. You probably can't read it, but the biggest there is a man called Arthur Bettesworth, who was some of your high church publishers on the town. The one he was most associated with, we know, with the books that we know he was involved in, is the trade publisher James Roberts. That is a wholesale distributor who did a couple of books, he buy the books off. He was the biggest publisher in that sense. And many of Curl's works only have Robert's name in ink, but we know that Curl was a person who paid for it. I love him, so that's not uncommon. Books, books. All of them. And there are perhaps, I don't know, 20. I think James Roberts was associated with his name. Is in an hour, is in the title page, really Curl's pulling the strings. He was never a member of one of the established conduits. It's got very dim. I'll see that name.
How many different titles have you identified? Or how many numbers?
It's just short of 1,200 now. Without the Zulu. Again, you can't read this, but all it is on the left hand side is our index number. Bottom right, the first number, the left hand column is the ESTC number. First the N's and the T's, and then on the right hand side is our corresponding index number. Done by them according to the ESTC number. We found about probably 60 items which are not in that precise state, edition or issue in the ESTC. Most of them have trivial differences. This is also fairly. These are newspaper advertisements. The ones he does most in are actually not on his page. We've got a lot there for the Daily Current, that's a very dull newspaper. The Daily Journal, there were rather more. He had phases of choosing one outlet and then another, and one organ rather than another, and then moving on to another. So there are, I forget how many.
Where were the London newspapers located in those days? Were they also in Fleet Street, or?
They were spread about, but there was a big group in Whitefriars off the East End of the
Harbour. Oh, okay, yeah.
Just below the 38th Circus there.
Yeah.
A lot were published there. So, some in the Savoy. Not, I think, Britain, some in the city. So I think there's not a big difference.
So he was constantly sending one of his clerks out with an advert and paying cash for it, presumably. There were no, as it were, bank transactions, I imagine, for things like that. How much did an advert cost?
Oh,
does anyone know?
Yes, there is a figure quoted, I think it's about 5 shillings for 3 insertions or something.
Yeah.
That's out of the top of my head, but there was a small figure like that. I think you might
have got a small figure. Mm-hmm. 5 shillings is it's weighted.
You might have, on a longer deal, if you had 30, kept doing it day after day, week after week. Some publishers did. Curl's not the biggest single advertiser. Some people in his period actually do more advertising. He's more notable for the cheap things he does and the sort of novelty. The narratives and poems he sticks in. In fact, he doesn't advertise books at all, there's hardly a silence. And sometimes there was obviously some kind of a template where they used the standard time. Curl tends to alter as in the light of this event. So if he's advertising something against Poland and something's happening in their battle, he'll put in a word or two in the middle of the ad. Taking account of what's happened in the last day or two, to keep the public abreast of the running battle. It's just to keep them abreast. That's the Fox and Index number on the left and the R number on the right. This is not in Strauss, and we have a lot of those, which I think is worth recording because people do still use Strauss, it's the name. I suppose that is dispensable. This is the ones about works and things like the Mansell catalog and the news magazine. Let me just go back to the contents. Yeah, it's got some blur, sorry about that. It doesn't look bad on my screen now. The thing we missed out. There are, I think it says there are 120 books or so in non Strauss. What are you asking about? The number of places to get imprints?
Yes. 40, I think it says.
Right. Some of them is quite brief here. Can you get that bigger?
Yeah.
No. The slide, bottom right, the sliding thing on the very, on the toolbar, further over. That should zoom.
Put it down onto that.
Where it says minus to plus, if you can get that thing, there you go. So it's only on 70% at the moment. No, a bit further along. That's better.
Okay, so thanks.
Yeah.
I did try and zoom it, I zoomed at home, but didn't zoom in. I tried to save it in June for a moment, but it doesn't work. I think one of the things that came up, that's why I came back to this.
The Geringer references, attacks on Pope.
Yeah.
How long did their quarrel continue, and how often, how many individual items were produced as a result of it? Was it a 10-year or a 20-year dispute? Were the weekly, monthly? Or?
Well, there are times when it's very, very intense and almost daily at the time of the publication of Pope's letters in 1735, for instance, or the town of Dantzig.
Yeah.
Sometimes there are brief intermissions, and
Was Curll publishing Pope's works without Pope's permission?
Well, it's another big question I haven't gone into.
Yeah.
Just to answer the first part.
Yes, sorry.
They start really about 1714. The first big flurry is 1716, and then they're at it in one or another until Pope's death in 1744, and then there is a life of Pope, published in 1745, the first big, longish life of Pope, which has generally been attributed to Curll. And again, it's very difficult to say that's in the matter. Some things in it are very clear, and he had been announcing for years and years that Percy was going to bring out a life of Pope. Some things that don't square look as if somebody had got at it, not Curll. So I'm not sure about that. But anyway, for 30 years essentially. And the number of items that relate to it, many are attacks on Pope, of course, or that use Pope, make jokes about him, dedicate books to Pope, bring in little couplets of Pope for no reason is probably maybe 80 to 100. The number that are squarely in the controversy, probably no more than about, I don't know, 15 or 20. Then there's the matter of Percy. Most people have talked of Curll as a pirate. There's currently an American scholar, Stephen Carling, has argued that most of Swift's things he produced with Swift were not released. And it's certainly true that in both those cases, and probably with Matthew Prior, who touched by law, there was some complicity on the part of the author. The author allowed the manuscript to get abroad, knowing it would reach Curll. In some cases, as we post letters, we know that he deliberately sent the manuscript to Curll. Or pretty changed the fact on the manuscript, I guess. So in many cases, there's no doubt that Curll was justified in proclaiming his innocence. On the other hand, most of the stuff published by Addison, most of the stuff published by Prior, a lot of material, he certainly did not have permission, he certainly never paid. In those cases, he didn't pay anything, even if he Pope had been complicit in getting the manuscript to him on the cover.
Sorry, are we in the discussion?
I think we've kind of segued into it.
Yeah, because I mean, this is fascinating, but I think the point we're now on with Brian is the one that I would be pressing you on, that say it's unique, but what are the conditions within which he was able to do this? I mean, there are various jurisdictions, there are various legislative frameworks, there are rules to do with what's pornography, there are rules to do what are apprenticeships. Most of your account, if I can say so, is treating Curll as if he was a personal agent who did this and had these opinions and you don't like it, what he did, and you bring in your own views there. But if you just say, well, he is an economic agent, we don't care anything about his character or his life, he's an economic agent who is finding some way in the circumstances of his age of making a living by moving in and out of various restrictions. Sometimes he may be moving his address, sometimes he may be putting a false title page or whatever it is. But these are the things that can actually be recovered, and I suspect because he operates in that very transitional period, just before and after the act of Queen Anne of 1710, that would answer your question, you know, why is he unique? Because he's unique because these sets of circumstances didn't exist for much longer after his time. And then you wouldn't have to speculate, you know, whether an author collaborated or not. You've got a kind of judgment-free, speculation-free model looking at this activity. And I think you've probably got enough to enable that to be done.
Well, all that is fair comment. Let me respond to two or three things you say, really. First of all, I don't think he was unique. I've actually written an essay in a book which Ian mentioned to me just before the name, on marriage and functions, which is on curling and the function trade. And there I tried to show the ways in which he was actually fairly often.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
In terms of the price, his pricing, his scale, his print runs on loading, which is not very often, scale, the amount he published, which was not the largest, it wasn't the biggest single publisher in output. One of the big ones, one of the biggest. And in several other ways, he's fairly in line with a lot of production practice of the day. So I don't mean to suggest that he's in every way unique. That's the first one. As to avoiding legal restrictions and so on, a lot of the things he did were very, very blatant. He did have all sorts of cunning ways of disguising things and doing things surreptitiously. He was very good at that at times. But some of the things he simply ignored and trusted to people either backing down or not having strong case. When he gets into cases, transfer cases such as the case on Cope versus Kerr or four or five others, he usually argues with great vigor and trenchancy that the Copyright Act has been misinterpreted, that it does not give the coverage thought to. And one of the things he does is argue, for instance, that translations, this was debated for some time, this was not an open track case initially. He argues that abridgments are not current, and therefore he can abridge other work that he's not rewritten. And this again is not absolutely straightforward law straight away. He loses a lot of these cases, in fact, but not all. And even in the case of Pope's letters, of course, when through the Pope's friends and Rathurst and people, the matter came before the House of Lords, Lord Delaware brought it up, the question of Pope's letters as being an infringement of, I think it was just an order of the House in 1721-22, that peers, the writings of Peers could not be reprinted without permission of the House of Lords. It was a breach of their privilege. A different area of law, of course, privilege law. This was lost. He did not succeed in that.
These are examples
of what
I was suggesting, because he kind of found these various loopholes and uncertainties in the law. But shortly after he stopped operating, most of those were closed, either legally or by other forms. So you don't get this anarchic book industry by the middle or later part of the 18th century. Right. It's all nicely tidied up. Yeah.
But of course,
so he's a man of his age.
Yeah. You know, living on the of course, a lot of people have already tried to tie it up and thought it had been tied up and thought it should be taken further. And this is why this issue of piracy, I think, is. Which Brian Resin, I should perhaps say a little bit more about. People thought it was a pirate at the time, not so much as the 19th century, I think, it's the Victorious, this was his main stock in trade. I think it is true to say that he didn't need to pirate a lot of his stuff. It was not really contested or in dispute. My own belief is this, I cannot prove now, is that he had various literary scavengers, of whom the most important, I think, was Richard Rawlinson, the Oxford Jacobite, non-Jerome Bishop, book collector, was his brother of Thomas Rawlinson. And there's several, I think, very strong pointers in this direction, I can't prove it, but they include the fact that Rawlinson is constantly reading things and querying books for Kerr at the same time. And then correspondence, they go on an antiquarian tour at one point together. But most important, I think, a lot of the manuscripts for books that Pearl produced, translations by Robert Sand and so on, are in Rawlinson's collections. That's where they ended up. And then they're among the few manuscripts for Pearl books that are survived. Not necessarily printed as copies, but they are the basis, the manuscript basis for Pearl printing books. And the only large source of those are Rawlinson's own collections. So I think he obviously had a man who went down to Doctor's Commons and read all the latest wills, because that was legal, and what he could do. So he wrote down Lady Delaware has left in the native grounds to the lover, and did it next week. So he had somebody down on Doctor's Commons to get him the wills. I think he had two or three other people follow, but I think that Rawlinson was a snapper up of unconsidered transfers in the literary and particularly the Oxford community. And so he publishes a lot more Oxford things than Cambridge things. Somebody there was feeling the stuff. And in a way, this was kind of uncontested. The literal position maybe wouldn't exactly, we now have a Copyright Act, and we have still trying to enforce the Stations Party, the Green, the Twain. We have various kinds of parliamentary measures like the British thing. And on the surface, things are getting tighter. But it seems to me for anyone who had enough confidence and chutzpah and willingness to risk getting the law, as it could, you could get away with a very great deal. So it's not as far on the road as perhaps the official institution history would suggest. The last point, I'll just touch on this, about situating you economically. We will do this as far as we can. Paul and I listed in the biography of Curl.
Is there a will of Curl?
Sorry?
Curl's will, do you have?
Yes,
that?
We have a will, but it's unwilling. Figures don't come to.
No estate at death, as in the ODMB?
No.
Sorry, economic.
Oh, yeah. We listed all the sort of surviving payments that we know of. Where we know the cost of printing, which I think is about 2 out of these 1,200, we would record that. Say what the payments were, the price, which of course stress doesn't give the price in every case.
Yeah.
And that sometimes also leads to arbitration. One of the main things that I haven't forgot to say earlier, before we stop, I should say, is the extraordinary longevity of his list. He advertises unsold copies, not at reduced prices usually, for 30 years. So that he publishes
that's the longest of the 18th century. We belong to the 19th century. Also, books in print for sometimes 30 or 40 years since the first.
What's that case? It's in the history of Oxford University Press, Harry Curtis. They produced an Armenian grammar or something in 1694. What's the name of the case? And it was still in print in 1820, and they sold 47 copies or something.
And the sacred books.
I've got those exact figures.
In print for 100 years. Yeah.
But anyway, even books that apparently never did very well are liable after a long gap. As well, you see, he'll publish something in 1713, push it for a while, it'll appear in newspaper ads, it'll appear, a large amount of his versions, of course, is in the books themselves, at the end of his books, or in the middle of his books, he has his own books in many sense. It'll be there for a few months, a year sometimes, not usually. It'll disappear for 20 years. He'll suddenly start advertising again. And of course, he has these catalogs, we haven't talked about that, but he's a big catalog merchant. And anything that actually was he never sold that he had not sold out of. If he had one remaining copy, he put that in his catalog.
So we haven't found any as he uses lining of trunks or book.
He must have had a big warehouse though, did his warehouse did it move around from premise to premise?
Particularly as also so many of his books are these, council title pages, which are just the sheets. Mr. Kepler's grandfather.
Kept the sheets?
They're not normally reset. Occasionally,
yeah.
There's some evidence of something being done in the
You should be able to get to that, because if you've got cost prices, as you say, cost of printing, cost of the final cost of and you've got retail final price, then you've got the gross
amount. In that case, we don't have them.
And there's various ways in which that could be.
We don't have them.
Do you know?
I thought you said you had some cost of printing.
About one or two.
One or two is enough.
I don't think paper came into that.
But you can find paper from all
of it. Well, it might be possible, but I think it would be interesting stuff. I don't think that's one of the more immediately productive areas, because I don't think it's very much energy. I'm not good point at all.
No, I'm just trying to push you. You've gathered all this information. I want to push you here to get maximum imagine.
I think it's so big and so important, it really requires a new project.
Yes.
God knows we spent long enough on this. We spent plenty of time on the biography. This in itself is really almost beyond my powers. I don't know about how I'll finish it when I get done in my lifetime. It's certainly the biggest enterprise I've ever undertaken in my life by a long way. And the sheer volume of data, unprocessed data, to get in without interpreting it at all. It's just so huge that I don't really with such a
Do you know the print ones for most of these?
In any few cases, mostly not.
What, is there a standard pattern or does it depend
the
on
popular pamphlets will be up to 1,000.
Right.
More common, I think. His antiquarian books probably 400 or 500, which again used to take a long time to unload. And you repackage it in ways and give a more eclectic title trying to someone's job a lot.
So at any one time, say in the middle of his career, or two-thirds of the way through his career, he's got unbound sheets for, let's say, 300 books.
Possibly.
Lying around in a warehouse. It must have. You're complaining about data, just think of this problem.
Yes, sir.
How did he keep the tabs on all
of that? Because he always tells people to go to his retail butcher. But there's a mysterious thing in the end of 1731, which some of these American scholars have written about, called the literatore, how do you pronounce it? Literatore. Literatore. And this, I think, was in Bow Street when his main retail outlet was on the other side of Covent Garden. King Street. It's just north of it's 2 miles away. And they speculated that it was a kind of book club from the Mayfair Street, and it was a kind of meeting house, or almost like a coffee house without a coffee. I see no evidence of this really. I think it was a kind of overflow warehouse. And they have sent people to Mr. Grandpa. How many assistants have been down in there? He had the only definite, well, he did two little interests, not very quickly. One is that in the early 1730s, just about the time of the he suddenly engages with a man otherwise unknown to history. He turns, I've tracked him down this sort of ruling, who was a mercer. In the Strand, he may either own the shop, goes in the one on the Strand, or the next door shop. His name is And this only lasted for a few months, but this is a man completely outside the trade, whose name suddenly appears in the imprints, presumably because he's called money to the business. This disappears. However, the only other thing I know about is Collins directly upon his son and his wife. In the, when was this? Yes, in the early 1730s, there is a terrible case of a girl who was a 16-year-old girl, I think, who was concerned, who was charged with stealing books from a bookstore in Bungo. And it was proved. And I think it was commuted to transportation, and she may have been sent to town with Curl. And Curl basically chopped her, I think, but he did not speak of it in defense. she was assisting, I think as a maidservant rather than book service assistant. So there was a maid in the place, there was a wife and a son, a wife most of the time, and a son until he died. I don't know that there was any other long-term assistant working in the shop there. But he may have had porters and infections. We know that in his chancery suit brought against him, a guy called Charles Davies, who was a publisher of partly antiquarian books and other things. Sorry, Carl sued him. And there's a story of a barrel load of books being crossed through the streets and tipped over or something. So there's a certain amount of porters turning and fro and just shipping books around the central London. So,
if you can identify the printers, some of them might be members of the stationers. Yeah, so there is, as you implied, quite a lot of shutting of eyes and going on here, turning the sun. Apart from the being a market for this, and presumably the people who bought this stuff are also members of the stationers' company.
I was just going to say, I can't reliably identify any printers. In some cases, the printers dated, maybe John Box or something, we give them ideas. Others, there may be some reference in correspondence, or it may come out when Curly is examined by the Secretary of State. In most cases, there isn't really a recognisable Curl House style. Bowyer certainly would be the oldest, certainly worked with once or twice. I was hoping that we'd be able to identify from printed ornaments, more than I would be able to do it again in 10 years to pursue both of them. Maybe Richardson once or twice, not often sentiment. So usually, I obviously don't know the identity of the printer. It would be nice to have a kind of a real Curl. You can occasionally look at a book which people suggested is Curl's, and you can say, just does it. Is not a Curl book. Just does not look like a Curl book, but that's the exception. Mostly just, I think, opportunistically used in printers available. Probably in bigger works in there, there's more than one printer.
Do you have facsimiles of the title pages of any of the books in the catalog?
We haven't got a catalogue yet. It's now all it is now is drafting the draft
sections. Yes, okay.
We haven't got that stage because I haven't completed. The silly reason I won't go into why there are indexes before the final numbers, but the consequence is that all the numbers in the indexes are going to have to be renumbered because I'm taking out 37A and such. There is a logic in why one isn't, and it can be done fairly mechanically. But there isn't the abbreviated catalogue, so all suggestions are welcome about what could go in, considering putting facsimiles. They're not usually tremendously unorthodox title pages, they are those of the age. They're inventive in putting in big letters the name of anybody who writes two lines in the book, and considering in small, tiny type and very small font, people who really did it. They're not very special. So, any advice on what you're going?
I was just thinking, while I totally agree that something like this should be in print form, because no way you can cross-reference on-screen material if you're going up and down. Even keeping tabs open within the same document is a nightmare. There might be a case for having a website, if you could find some munificent university, with all the title pages scanned, because one never knows what future scholars might be able to do with this evidence. And, someone in a rare library somewhere in Yugoslavia or Canada or might be able to identify a book.
It's not expensive. The company that I'm the chair of, Open Book Publishers, publishes in both formats, both as a proper codex and write-on, and as online. So you can read it and search online, which you can't do. There are also associated pages which are called resources, where you just put in anything you like, And if you put in all the ornaments, I'm sure there would be some nerd somewhere in somewhere. Well, you would immediately say that. I recognize that the ornament is coming.
That's worth it. I'm just asking. I'm saying ask him over. That's
what I'm saying.
Well, that's marvelous. This is the
kind of
resource that we should be exploiting.
This is the most munificent university all the way down in touch. And whether how much it applies anywhere
not for
in
the next
few years, no idea. My own university is taking very big steps.
Well, this, if you want to write to me, we don't actually require any subsidy for the course, because the costs are actually very small. If the author does all the work, the cost of manufacturing printed book to a high standard are peanuts, a pound and something.
I wish you'd tell that the publishers are rejecting that book.
Yeah, they're not rejecting on grounds of the manufacturing cost.
Are they? They
sorry, we're moving on to another area, but we'll have to talk about this.
But this is a crucial academic issue, because I know many colleagues who submit a book which would come out at 210 pages, and the publisher comes back and says, no, we can't handle anything more than 186 pages. So there is some...
Typical academic monograph, Cambridge Press, Oxford Press, London Press, it's 500 copies, selling at about £60.
That's right.
And of those 500, 300 go to a number of well-endowed universities, mainly in North America, and then they're borrowed by less than somewhere between 5 and 10 people. And the cost of one active reading of these manuals cannot be less than about £10,000 each active reading. Now, if you move to the more modern form of gaming, you get the retail price is only £60, it's more like £20.
Yeah.
And you can correct any errors immediately, just by trying to be more. We have all these other
things. Because I was going to ask you before the interview.
So look at our website.
What people think in general about principle of doing online is against print.
Because a bibliographer, this cries out to be amended, doesn't it? I mean, it's going to be perfect the day you send it to the printer.
Absolutely.
But within a short time, you're going to wish to add or change the date.
But what do you do? Wait forever and never do it?
No, you have to have a digital form.
That's a big issue. Another big issue that crossed my mind about the ESTC, which in my past I've been involved with. You see 60 books not listed in the ESTC.
Not books, I mean editions.
Or editions. Mm-hmm. Now, the ESTC has been in existence 30 years. Is this a bit of a scandal that it's still missing that number, or are they really obscure locations?
A lot of them are obscure locations. Mm-hmm. The variants are pretty slender in many cases. I mean, the number that are really completely unknown books that don't exist in any form of ASTC is much, much lower. Mm-hmm. Might be 4 or 5.
Will you communicate your list to ESDC? Certainly.
But EST is only still a fragment of what once existed. So that's why you get these very progressive curves, because so much can be lost. If you could find, as it were, some ratio of survivability of ESDC at this period, that could be then projected back to get much more than just cover.
That's another point. I should have added, as against all this huge number of reading ghosts, there are a very small number of books recorded as closed and published, for which no copies of ours, but I believe did exist.
Yeah. You want those.
But that's a very much more than a number of ghosts.
So those are in your index?
Yes.
No copies of mine?
Exactly.
Mm, good.
No, just an index in the main.
Oh, sorry, I missed it in the catalogue.
I wonder if I could draw a formal proceedings to a close, because unfortunately I have to go to another meeting. Could I start by thanking your two interlocutors who have added to what was what for me was a fascinating talk. I'm sure they would certainly agree. And so we ought especially to thank our speaker, who's been an excellent visiting professor or fellow at Thornton School. I hope you've enjoyed your time with us and that it's been profitable. And thank you so much for today's lecture and run through of your catalogue. It's absolutely fascinating.
Thank you, Charlie.